Chris and Chris Talk Movies.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. My name is Chris Ferry, and of course, this is my co-host.
My name is Chris Huddleston.
And today, we are both very excited to be talking to you about the brand new, critically acclaimed film, Poor Things.
This is Bella. Bella, this is Mr. McCandles.
Hello, Bella.
She's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she is progressing at an accelerated pace.
Tell me, where did she come from?
I shall. For it is a happy tale.
I am Bella Baxter. And there is a world to enjoy, circumnavigate. It is the goal of all to progress, grow.
A woman plotting her course to freedom. How delightful.
Do you have a synopsis for us, Mr. Huddleston?
I do. It is a 2023 film. The synopsis from Rotten Tomatoes. From filmmaker Yorgos Lanthimos and producer Emma Stone comes the incredible tale and fantastical evolution of Bella Baxter, played by Emma Stone, a young woman brought back to life by the brilliant and unorthodox scientist Dr. Godwin Baxter, Willem Dafoe. Under Baxter's protection, Bella is eager to learn. Hungry for the worldliness she is lacking, Bella runs off with Duncan Wedderburn, Mark Ruffalo, a slick and debauched lawyer on a whirlwind adventure across the continents. Free from the prejudices of her times, Bella grows steadfast in her purpose to stand for equality and liberation. So I saw this in the theater a few weeks ago, and then you actually watched this just last night. This is on Hulu, so if anybody has Hulu, it is available to watch on Hulu. So what
you can
you
also
think?
You can rent it too on say Prime or Apple TV if you want to do that. And so I watched it on the biggest TV I had available. It's not huge by today's TV standards, but it was, you know, I didn't watch it on my phone. I wish that I had seen this in the theater. It's visually stunning. What did I think of it? It kind of blew me away on a number of levels. And I know I'm not unique in thinking this is a remarkable film, but I'm genuinely super excited to talk about this with you today because there's just so much to discuss. We should say, for those of you who may not have ever heard us before, we're not professional reviewers. We're just two friends who love movies and like to talk about movies. We do spoil these movies. So especially on ones where it just came out, it's gotten some Academy Award notice. It just became available. We talk about the ending. We talk about everything in between. So especially on this one part, I knew a thing or two about it. I didn't know a ton about it. I knew the broad strokes. Part of my delight in this movie was being surprised by the specificity and the choices. And so without saying too much more, if you think you want to see this, I encourage you to actually pause us and come back to this episode after you've seen it, because I don't think it'll disappoint. So, I mean, normally I go in a long monologue, which I guess I kind of just did anyway. I loved it. What did you think? What's your first impression?
So I went in very cold. I mean, I'd seen the trailer, but that was about it. I knew as soon as I saw the trailer, I thought, I have to see this. And so I didn't read anything about it. You know, I tried to know as little as possible. And I felt like there were a lot of surprises. So my initial impression, the first 15 minutes or so, I had to adjust because it's so weird. This is a weird movie. And it's the music is at times is just discordant, almost. This is probably the best way I could describe it, where it's just sort of noises and things. And to, so this is, I mean, we find out this out fairly early on in the movie, but this is, so Emma Stone is a woman who, she tries to kill herself. She jumps off of a bridge, and Willem Dafoe has gotten her body, and he's kind of a Dr. Frankenstein. I thought initially, until they start calling him God or Godwin, I thought he was supposed to be Dr. Frankenstein.
Oh, I see. Literally.
Yeah, I thought literally he was Dr. Frankenstein, you know, until they said his name. But he works at a medical, you know, he's a teacher or professor at a medical school, you know.
Surgeon.
But, yeah, surgeon. And but around his house, he has these various animal hybrids where there's like a, what one is a chicken with a pig's head and, you know, or a dog's head or something. And, but anyway, so she was a woman who she tried to commit suicide, and it turned out she was pregnant, and he takes the baby's brain and puts it in her body. So the first little bit of the movie is her, she acts like a baby. And, you know, like I say, this first little bit, the weird music and this, I thought, if this is going to be her as a baby, this whole, I don't know if I could take this or not. But basically, Mark Ruffalo shows up. And then I really felt like the movie took, and that's pretty early on, and maybe 20, 25 minutes in or something. And he is playing against type, where he's this real creep. And he takes her away, takes her off on the ship, and then the film goes from there. But like you said, this movie is visually stunning. I, the last movie that I can really remember being blown away to this degree by the visuals was probably Crimson Peak, which was another movie that I saw in the theater. But this is, you know, there are parts where they're on obvious sets and they don't even try to hide the fact that they're sets. And it, you know, you're in the real world, but there are things like these cars that are in the sky on these kind of lines, you know, that, and, but, the part, my favorite section of the film is when they're on the ship. That ship was just incredible. And that's one of those things, you know, where people talk about, you know, when the first Avatar came out, people were like, oh, I want to, I got sad because I went to the movie and then I didn't want to come out of Pandora. I wanted to live on this ship in this movie, you know? But so Mark Ruffalo is amazing. I mean, Emma Stone won the Oscar, as best actress. I didn't see a lot of the other nominated films, but I was really happy that she won because I just think it's an incredible performance. And I'd like to, you know, we can get into this some with you from an acting standpoint, like just the lengths that she goes to. It's interesting because there's a part in the film where she becomes a prostitute, and she is, you know, you don't see this a lot with big stars these days, where she's completely naked for long stretches of this movie, basically. So, you know, she's very vulnerable in many, many ways. But it's just, I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen anything quite like this movie.
You touched on so much that I want to drill down into. Okay. And I think let's try and kind of group, make some groups here. The performances, absolutely, we need to talk about. Never seen Mark Ruffalo do anything like that.
And he's hilarious.
He's wonderful.
And that's one thing about this movie.
Yeah.
It's a horror movie, you know, but it's certainly
horrific at times.
And you know, there's some violent things in it, but it's a funny movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of humor in this.
I agree. So, one thing we can sort of group and talk about a design, because I agree with you. I think the world of this film is so incredibly specific and unique. It's sort of a steampunk. It's sort of mm-hmm. that time of the Victorian Industrial Revolution where everyone was fascinated with they have sort of steam carriages that aren't quite cars yet. You know, when people were still wearing the bustles and the big shoulders. The costumes were spectacular. She had the sort of puffy sleeves, but they were taken to the nth degree.
And she it goes was... around. It's weird because she, you know, because she has this childlike, you know, it's like she's just like a child, like learn. And the thing is that happens is she rapidly progresses. Her
yes.
her intelligence happens. I mean, it's just over like a course of days or weeks or whatever. But like, you know, you have all the women in their big sort of hoop skirts, and she's walking around in these like almost sort of like disco
kind of go-go boots with yeah, kind of like kitten sort of heels and a mini skirt, a sort of a that looks like a slip of it, you know.
Yeah,
it none of it makes any sense, but it all makes perfect sense. The movie is dreamlike in that way. The way that it's shot is quite remarkable. The way that it's scored when she is still sort of baby-like and she's developing, it's in black and white. And then, you know, Wizard of Oz-like, it switches into color and the color is gorgeously saturated. And
there are different aspect ratios too.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of times it's shot with this kind of really intense fisheye lens. Mm-hmm. And other times it's shot through a sort of an aperture, like you're looking through a little hole drilled in a wall, mm-hmm. and this whole screen is black, but there's this little, you know, central picture in the middle as though you're, you know, you're peeping in at the action. I would need to watch it at least once more to see if I could figure out a rhyme or reason to it. I'm positive it's not arbitrary. Mm-mm. But it felt arbitrary on the first watch. It felt like the intention was to disorient and create an emotional response in us, the viewer, without it having like a really literal didactic meaning. You know, so much of this movie is visceral, literally, and sort of figuratively. There's a lot of sex in this movie. One of the things I want to kind of try and pick apart is what this movie is. It's kind of a fairy tale. It's kind of a horror film. It's a coming of age story. It's it's a treatise on feminism, you know, and the patriarchy. And I mean, it's just so much, and it's so, so weird. Mm-hmm. I thought everything about it was delightful. Willem Dafoe. His character, the sort of Dr. Frankenstein character.
With his horrible
character.
Makeup.
Yes. Just,
where he's all scarred.
Oh, he himself looks like Frankenstein's mm-hmm. monster. And we discover through the course of the film that his father, who was a famous surgeon and a sort of experimental scientist, experimented on Willem Dafoe's care as a child. And that was the father. And he's constantly defending this brilliant man that was his father, who by the end of the movie, you're like, your father was a psychopath. I mean, none of your descriptions make it sound like your father did it because he enjoyed doing this thing. But he experimented on his own son because that was the subject he had complete control over. It's like and there is a sort of an Igor character who is one of the students of Willem Dafoe, who sort of recognizes a kind of an open-mindedness who invites him into the house to record data on this experiment. He saves Emma Stone's, Belle is her name, Bella. He is what he names her. He saves her. It's an experiment. He doesn't know who she is ahead of time. She jumps off a bridge into the water and drowns. We learn later, because the woman she was hated being pregnant, hated this pregnancy. And it would created this kind of, suicidal depression in her, or at least that's what the husband, who turns out to be a total nightmare, mm-hmm. says. And the body washes up on the shore, and then we don't get the detail, but we see this kind of big meaty guy in a bowler, his silhouette. And we just presume that, like a lot of doctors at that time, you would pay someone some silver pieces to like bring your bodies to autopsy. Mm-hmm. That's, you know,
yeah.
So this body washes up on shore. That's worth something to him. And the guy brings it in and he discovers that the woman is 100% dead, but is pregnant, and the child is still alive inside of her. So You know, it doesn't get into why he does this other than I wonder if this is possible, right? I put a pig's head on a chicken and, duck's head on a dog and things like that.
Yeah, there's no morality with any of this. It's all simply science, you know, in his mind.
You know, and to me, the poor things are all of us, but literally they are these kind of, you know... It is Willem Dafoe, and it is everybody that lives in this place are these kind of outcast, misfit toys, broken things, different things, intelligent in different way things. Like, it really is, it's a wonderful name for this because it sort of speaks to the societal condescension of anything that's different, anything that's out. They say that or not, polite society. Polite society will kill you. Like a number of people are like, ugh, polite society, that's the worst. Oh God, I'm just rambling at full speed. I stop me anytime here. But anyway,
no, keep going.
He and this sort of Igor figure, I don't remember that character's name, although he's good too.
Mm-hmm.
They become very fond of her. She's wonderful. And I think in that first part, before her personality fully develops and she goes from baby to toddler to,
adolescent.
Yeah, pre-adolescent to adolescent, and sort of discovers sexuality and discovers all of these different stages. Somebody finds a frog and says, look, and she's like, kill it. You know, so it's like,
yeah,
it's very, very frank about, you know, human development and the natural impulses. And this doctor who comes to very, very much care about her, she represents all women, but she also represents a really remarkable individual that is unique, right? That is this sort of, it's mother and daughter and hybrid and monster and, right? So, so you can't really pin anything down. And on paper, I would have said this movie just won't work. I'm like, you know, that sounds like a lot to tackle. Good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wouldn't have believed that it would fly and this soars. I think her performance, I know I'm jumping all over the place. I think her performance in that first part is like, I'll never see Emma Stone in the same way again. And I was a fan. I like Emma Stone. I think she's funny. I think she's a good dramatic actor. The first part of this, up to the point where she basically discovers her own sexuality and a little past that, I was like, I just have never seen. Very rarely do you see acting like that, where the person just absolutely vanishes into this character in that way. And I qualify it with the first half because I think as we get into the second half and she develops a more adult vocabulary and she develops a sense of cynicism about the world and a sense of realization that she's had a comparatively comfortable life and that people really are quite horrible to each other, it starts to become a little more recognizable to the Emma Stone that I've seen in other, you know, films. It doesn't break, Bella doesn't go away. She just becomes a more fully realized adult, and that's more recognizable as Emma Stone. But for the first whole half of the movie, it's just bonkers. And this Lothario, who I wouldn't have said he could do that part.
He wouldn't have been the first person that would come to mind, but he's
Mark Ruffalo,
fantastic in this.
Is such a slick skunk. It's Pepe Le Pew, delicious and vile. And she doesn't intend to do it, but he even says at one point, he goes, I've become the thing I detest. Like, I'm the, you know, I'm the vampiric lover who can't get enough. And he's absolutely destroyed by her.
It's probably never happened to him by, you know, he's probably
no, he's never
the one
wanted
doing the, doing the destroying, you know.
He's never met a lover that he couldn't, you know, have and leave at his whim. He discovers that he wants nothing else in the world but 100% Bella all the time.
It's funny how he changes, how he
just kidnaps becomes, her. He's like, get in the box. And she gets in the steamer trunk. And then when he opens the box, they're on a ship, you know, because she can't escape.
But he just becomes so pathetic, you know, and it's fun. It's fun to see that the way that he changes at the same time that she's becoming more and more intelligent and more understanding. And like you said, that kind of childlike wonder starts to go away. There's a part where there's a couple, they're not really, they're like, they're friends. It's a man
traveling
and a woman.
Companions.
Yeah, traveling companions. And there's a part where the ship stops and he takes her off, and you can see this area where there's all these like very poor people. And she becomes, you know, that really resonates with her. And Mark Ruffalo is this, he's gambling all the time and he wins all this money. And she takes her money and gives it to a couple of the guys working on the ship because they tell her that they'll take the money to the poor people. And she's like, I gave the money to them to give to the poor people. You didn't need the money, you know.
Right. So, and 100% they kept it for themselves. Like, yeah, that's exactly. Super clear.
Like, oh, sure, we'll take your money to the poor people.
Everything in this movie is dialectical, right? Everything in this movie is both things at once, you know? So she becomes incredibly worldly and remains utterly frank. It is a movie about how horrible men are and how misogynistic men are and how patriarchal, you know, polite society is and what fragile, broken little boys men are, right? Like it's just constantly reinforcing both the veneer and the underlying truth. And it does that visually. Life is a kind of an unfair struggle, and it's this sumptuous buffet, right? She eats these little cakes. They go to Portugal, and they eat this, and he's like, you have to stuff the whole thing in your mouth. That's how you eat it. You don't eat it bite by bite. And she does, and it's very childlike and very gluttonous, and she's like, more. And he's like, no, one's enough. You drop one in. So he gets drunk and she sneaks out. She leaves basically, and she eats like 20 of them. And then there's this, you know, cause she's like, screw that. I'm going to, you know, and then there's a shot of her vomiting it all back up later because it's too much.
And she goes to a bar. I don't think she's ever had alcohol before. And she just like drinks a whole bottle of liquor.
Yeah. And passes out. And it's just, you know, she's still very childlike, and she decides, I'm going to go leave with this guy. And everyone's like, oh, that's a terrible idea. Like, it's so dangerous out there. You're going to, you know, and it's all kind of like, well, not she'll be fine, but she has to go live her life. You know, I mean, she'll learn things about it. Things will happen.
And the funny thing is, the interesting thing is, you keep waiting for something really terrible to happen to her. But she's always in control of what she's doing because she's so smart. Even towards the end, where she goes back to the husband, who turns out to be this psychotic guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, she's able to, and you think like, oh, this is really, but she's able to get that out of that as well. I think with this movie, you know, we talk so much. I mean, we've talked about some really good movies on this show, but we talk so much about how so many movies now are just so bland and they're done by committee and all, and they don't take any kind of chances. And this is the kind of movie that you can get when you have a truly visionary director. And apparently, you know, you had I think this is an A24 movie, I'm pretty sure.
They just
pretty much let him do whatever he wanted to do. Have you seen any of his other movies? He did The Lobster. He did The Killing of a Sacred Deer. He did The Favorite.
I have not, but I'm going to watch them all now.
Yeah.
What's remarkable to me about this is it doesn't fit a pattern. It's not a template. It's not, you know, he's like, we've never seen this movie before. You know, Tim Burton, when he did Beetlejuice or Edward Scissorhands, there was such a visual uniqueness to that, such a bold and specific visual style that we've all come to recognize as Tim Burton now. But at the time it was like, what is this? Right. But the stories weren't out of the, I mean, they weren't pat, but Edward Scissorhands was a story about an orphan. And yes, he was a weird, it was a Pinocchio story. Right. I mean, I guess to be fair, you say this is a Frankenstein story, but I don't know. I feel like this pushes it to a new level on so many fronts. The visual design, every element, and the audio design and the way it's shot and the performances and the directing and the story. If you had to describe, like, so what happens in this movie? You're basically like, well, what you said, a mad scientist basically puts the brain of a baby into its dead mother's corpse. And so, and then it takes, and she grows up as an infant and experiences life. There's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can tell the plot points, but the summary of it, it's just following her through her life, you know? And it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, describing it sounds like, huh? Yeah, I'll check that one out. You're like, you should, because it's really unlike anything I think I've ever seen.
Now, it is definitely not. Did you watch this just by yourself, or did you watch it with Rachel?
No, I just watched it by myself.
Do you think Rachel would be into it, or is it?
Do you know? I think she would appreciate the design elements of it for sure. I think that.
Because this is not a movie for everyone. I mean, there definitely would be people that just be like, ah, I didn't get it. And it's weird. And, you know,
she might or might not be as patient with the weirdness, you know, because some of it really threads a needle, like the rooster with a dog's head on it and the dog with a goose's head on it. Those abominations are both funny and horrifying, right? Mm-hmm. The lab, the doctor himself, it turns out his father was cut him open and cut out like parts of his digestive system to see what they did and if we could function without them. And it,
oh yeah, there's a weird thing.
We can't.
When he eats, he has like this machine and like these bubbles come out of his mouth.
He has this whole apparatus behind him with two kind of like, almost like colostomy ports on the side. He's like, my body can't produce, because my dad cut those organs out. So my body can't produce the you know, the fluids I need to digest food. So I have to hook myself with this machine to eat. And he says, as a matter of fact, they're like, he was a brilliant man.
You know? Yeah.
And at the end of the meal, he kind of goes,
And a big bubble comes out. Yeah.
And it's cute and funny and disgusting and horrifying. Like, it's all of those things in equal measure. And everybody, in a very Victorian way, is just sitting around and, like, watching it happen. I love those scenes where they're all, like, playing ball. And somebody will say something a little outside the lines. And they'll all kind of raise an eyebrow. Go, and Bella will just be like, you know, just throw up on the table or something, and everybody is scandalized, you know, and she's just like, I don't understand why we're playing by these rules don't make any sense. You know, she's not a rebel by policy. She's just like, I'm living my life and people tell me I can't do things, but I don't understand why can't I? I just did it, you know,
because it's pretty much like if a child were an adult, essentially. You know, I mean, that's basically how she behaves. But because she's an adult body and not a child, people treat her like she's an adult.
And she doesn't feel beholden to anyone.
No. Yeah, and, you know, you give this same script to a lot of other directors, and this would probably be unwatchable. I mean, it's amazing that this all worked, as strange as it is.
It almost seems like a dream this director had fully formed and like woke up and managed to get it all on paper or retain it and say, because there is such specificity to it. And that only comes from a director. You only get a performance like this out of an actor that you know is capable of it, but that you can give very specific feedback, mm-hmm. you know, that you can give very specific direction and guidance to. And so it is a credit to Emma Stone that she can go that deep. You know, you're right. The first time we see her bare breasts, I think, is she discovers masturbation the way a child would. And it is remarkable how frank it is. It is not, there's nothing pornographic to it. And if anything, it is, you're aware of the sort of taboo. I felt a little uncomfortable watching someone discover, you know, a character discover this moment, but I also felt fascinated, and I also felt let off the hook because it seemed like the most natural thing in the world. Like, it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel any arousal, which was what I think we mostly see that pitched as in society. Like, anything sexual is either shame or it's a turn on. Mm-hmm. And it ignores this entire other, the rest of the 360 degrees of it, which is that, you know, sex is about as fundamental as anything gets in our lives. And it goes the whole range. Like, people have sex with each other because they hate each other, and they do it because they're bored. And sometimes it's just like scratching an itch. And it's, you know, it is fundamentally human. And I feel like this is a movie with tons of sex in it. And when she goes into the cat house and she's that's a character I want to talk about is the madam. Mm-hmm. We see her having sex with a number of different people, and it is almost, she's like her, you know, quote unquote father. She's experimenting. She says, I want to be a scientist. I want to be a doctor. I'm fascinated by exploring the world and experimenting with things, and having sex with all these different men and women is an experimental thing for her. And she experiences it in her body. She takes great pleasure from it sometimes, and she's indifferent to it in other times. And it's a little upsetting or discomforting or off-putting to her at other times. There's a scene where there's just sort of this guy, this John comes in, and she has this whole little patter with him. And this is sort of in the middle where she's like, you're going to tell me a memory from your childhood, and I'm going to tell you a joke, and then I'm going to have a sniff of you. And if you stink, I'm going to give you some lavender oil to take care of that. And then we can do the jumping up. She has a funny name for sex, and then we can do it.
Jumping or something. Yeah.
And the guy's like, okay. And he speaks only in French, and he tells a story from his childhood, right? And she tells a joke, and he laughs. He loves that joke. And then she has a sniff of his armpit, and she's like, okay, you don't smell too bad. We can do this. Mm-hmm. And then they end up having great sex.
It is very matter of fact. You know.
Yes, but I don't know. It lets us into the experience. It refuses to be... you know, the Mark Ruffalo character tries this. You're a whore. You know, he tries mm-hmm. to put it all in boxes. And she's just always experimenting. You know, I'm just trying to understand. You know, I need money. This is the quickest way to get it. But the madam character
mm-hmm.
Is this terrific actor that I have seen in a couple of other things recently. She was in the Macbeth, that
the Cohen ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, with okay. She was the witches, all three of the witches.
How was that? I haven't seen it.
It was really interesting. I mean, I think if you're into Macbeth, it'd seem more interesting. Mm-hmm. Denzel Washington. Plays Macbeth. It's interesting. It's on Apple TV. Anyway, she's a vampire, and not because in the film she literally drinks blood, but like when she explains, when I see something pretty, I have to bite it. She like bites Bella's earlobe, and there's another scene where she kind of comes into the bed and she's saying, "No, but you have to understand, you know, there's this seduction to it." She's covered with tattoos, but then she bites, you know, then she finds a place to bite Bella, and Bella's like, "Ah," you know, it's just kind of the thing, but she's feeding on, you know what I mean? She's mm-hmm. like, then later Bella goes back to the Igor character who she's betrothed to marry. And she's like, "Yes, I charge 30 francs." And he's like, "That seems low." Like, that's his response. Yeah. He's like, "That doesn't seem like you were charging enough."
Yeah.
And all of that seems to underline that that really wasn't why anybody was doing it. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. just so many layers going on in every scene and every element of this film. And it's, oh man, so, so good. I have to watch it again. I think I have to take a break and read some stuff and process it a little bit, but I've got to go back. I think it was enormously satisfying on a single watch, but there's just so much there that there's no way I caught it all on the first viewing.
And I didn't rewatch it before we recorded, you know, so I'm just going from memory from a few weeks ago. But yeah, I want to watch it again. From another thing from a technical standpoint, now, I don't know if this, watching it on TV, if this showed through or not, but watching it on a big screen, and at times I noticed a lot of grain in the, and I thought, I wonder, you know, if that's something that they've done digitally. And then I read after that they shot on film, and I bet that when there's the different aspect ratios, I bet they use different film stocks. You know, I bet they shot on like 18 millimeter or whatever it is. And then, you know, 35 and to get those, you know, kind of those different looks.
That I don't know enough about
16 millimeter. I mean,
yeah, I don't know enough about that to like get the full film school effect out of it, but I am interested in process, and that would be cool to learn about. None of it felt arbitrary. Like there's nothing in this film felt arbitrary. So it's hard for me to imagine that they shot on a collage of stuff and put it together in post.
No.
That would flabbergast me if that was the case, because
people are always wanting to compare modern directors to Stanley Kubrick, but I feel like this guy is kind of in that Stanley Kubrick vein from the stand. Not that he's making the same kind of films that Stanley Kubrick made, but that he appears to be with this film, that he was just in complete control at all times. Like you said, nothing feels arbitrary.
It doesn't feel obsessive. Like occasionally Kubrick's films feel a little obsessive. And that's not a criticism. I think that's part of their absolute appeal. This did not feel obsessive to me, but it did feel absolutely sure-footed.
And Kubrick, you know, I love Kubrick, but his films are so cold, whereas this film has a lot of warmth to it. I felt
a lot of heat, and I don't mean that like in a, there are some times that one of her Johns is a priest, we discover, and we see her having what they're supposed to say to their Johns when they leave is formidable, right? Like, hey, formidable, buddy, you know, and merci. And there's one ugly dude that comes in and just kind of rogers her roundly, you know, she's kind of hanging on by one hand throughout it. And then, you know, he's getting dressed and puts on his hat, and she's on the chaise, and she's like, formidable. Merci. You know, it's like, that's le mot juste. That is precisely what that was. And then she's having this passionate sex with this guy. And it's clearly like they are both, it's amazing sex. Mm. And then afterwards, she says, God has given you a gift, my friend. Mm-hmm. And he's getting dressed, and he's a priest. And he says, yeah. Oh, it's a curse or something like that, you know, in French.
Yeah.
It's damnation, you know, and he sort of slinks out. But it's just kind of constantly tweaking the nipple of society and poking it in the eye and prodding and slicing the skin open to see what's underneath it. And
when there's even a father, not a priest, a dad, who yeah. brings his two sons in.
Who don't seem particularly interested. Like
no, but he wants, it's basically for, you know, it's like he's, you know, literally showing the birds, not literally showing the birds and the bees, but, you know, demonstrating the birds and the bees for them and has them, you know, like taking notes.
The younger one is like deciduously yeah. taking notes and yeah. the other one is sort of sitting there stone-faced, bored, like my dad does stuff like this.
Yeah.
And it's taking a while. And mm-hmm. so she turns to the kids, like she's participating in the education. She yeah. turns to the kids while he's kind of grinding away. And she's like, you know, to speed things along, sometimes a finger in the ass or a little choking will finish it off. So she grabs yeah. him by the neck and gives him a little squeeze. And then he's like, oh, yeah. she's like, oh, there we go. You know, the younger kid's taking these notes. So it's like, on the one hand, you're just like, this is perverse. Like we're watching child abuse, you know, there's a part of your brain that's like, this is criminal. And then there's another part of your brain that's like, this is absurd. This is a comedy and this is ridiculous. And somewhere in that harmonic, the message is human beings are deeply, deeply messed up. And we do deeply messed up stuff all the time. And it's not the exception. It's the rule. Mm-hmm. Right? We create these mores for ourselves and then we're constantly subverting them and not, you know, and hiding that we don't follow them. Oh, man. And yet it has this message throughout woven into the tapestry and it avoids feeling like it's stuffing it down your throat or beating you over the head with it. It's not a didactic, excuse me, or preachy feeling movie. And
no,
you know, I found it entertaining and upsetting and stimulating and exciting and beautiful and sad and weird. And, you know, it was this kaleidoscope of human experience and all of it felt 100%. I thought of like someone like a circus performer riding a unicycle across a high wire with no net in the circus.
Mm-hmm.
And them doing it with such surety that you don't feel afraid for that person's safety. This thing felt so steady footed every step of the way. And I just, that is perhaps the most amazing thing. Cause it's such an all over the place, out of the box, cuckoo birds, crazy movie.
Yeah, for sure. And, again, you know, you had producers or a studio or whatever that had could obviously see that this, you know, I guess was going to be some, you know, took a chance that this would be something special. And it really is.
I listened to a podcast, the Smartless podcast with Emma Stone was on it. And she was talking about, she basically went to this director and was like, I beg of you on my knees, put me in one of your films. You know, I don't care in what capacity I will do anything. Put me in one of your movies. And she ended up getting to play this part, but I'm like,
she is also in The Favorite also, which is a, I forget which queen it's about. It's a little more, I mean, it's more conventional than this,
same,
but it's
same
still,
director,
same director. Yeah. And she's actually going to be in his next movie as well. Mm. That's already been announced that whatever his next movie is going to be. But The Favorite is more, it's more conventional, but it's still funny and weird. I mean, everything that I've seen of his, I've seen The Lobster, I've seen The Favorite. I haven't seen Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Those are the only two I've heard anything about. The Lobster I heard about and The Killing of Sacred Deer I heard about.
The Favorite had some Oscar nominations as well. I don't remember exactly if anybody won or if it won anything, but yeah, I mean, he's a great filmmaker. And this kind of, you know, it just touches, like you said, it touches on so many things and kind of so many different buttons. Right after I watched this, I went on Letterboxd and was reading reviews on there. And it's funny because it's like five star, one star, five star. It's like either people love it or they think it's like the worst thing they've ever seen. And there, it was interesting because there are the people that, you know, were giving it one stars are like, it's pornographic. And it's a lot of the commenters were saying, you know, this is being presented as this female empowerment movie, but it's actually the opposite because she's selling herself for sex, you know? And it's like, no, you never, you know, she never does anything that she doesn't want to do. No one ever, you know, none of the Johns try to kill her or anything or beat her up or anything like that. She's always in control. And, you know, and it's like you were saying, she approaches everything from the scientific stand. And by the end of the movie, she's kind of come, I don't know if full circle is the right term, but she is now like, she wants to do the same thing as her father.
Right.
You know, who she, and it's interesting where his name is Godwin, but she calls him God through, because he's basically God to her.
Right.
You know, which I thought was interesting as well.
Which is another example
of created her.
It's a kind of a subtle, but right on the nose. You know, the whole thing is kind of like, oh, that's a little too on the nose. And you're like, well, no, that actually works. You know, it's like everything is both. Everything is means nothing and everything and is too much and not enough. And so good. Yeah. I mean, you would expect that. I wouldn't think a great film wouldn't get some zero, one star reviews. There's just going to be some people that don't get great art. There's just going to be some people that don't get it. And I think to be fair, some of it is expectation too, right? I mean, we made a movie a while ago that was kind of a mess of a movie. It was really about possession. It was a kid's spirit that was trying to get back to its mother. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of possessing people, hopping from body to body. It was kind of a mess. And the original title of the film was Tantrum. And we sold it and we made our money back, what little money we spent on it. And the company that bought it marketed it as a zombie film. They called it Rise of the Dead. And on the cover, they put like a zombie bursting out of the ground. And it literally says like lots of flesh chomping, you know, and I'm like, this is not the movie. And so we got some reviews that were like, you know, this actually wasn't a bad movie. It was a really messed up, like in a good way. The ending is worth it if you make it all the way to the ending. It's 100% not a zombie movie, but that was probably the people that saw, right? And then there were other people that were like, oh, I wanted a zombie movie and I went to Blockbusters and I rented this and it's not a zombie movie and what are you trying to pull? And I get it. That is a bait and switch, and it would make me angry too. You know? So, I mean, there's going to be, like, I was expecting to see a comedy, or I was expecting to see, you know, Emma Stone, like she was in La La Land or something. And this is not that. Whatever you thought it was going to be, it's not that. Yeah. So, unless you went into it with kind of an open heart and brain and were just like, didn't let go of the tiger's tail and went on the ride, you're going to be let down because it's none of those things. It's just nuts.
Have you ever seen The Squid and the Whale?
Oh, I love that movie.
There's a great, one of my favorite lines of that is where the dad is talking to the son and there's the guy who's the, I think he's talking about the guy who's the tennis coach. And he's like, oh, son, he's a Philistine. And he's like, what's a Philistine? And he's like, oh, a Philistine's somebody who doesn't read or watch interesting films. Yeah. And I've always loved that line.
Yeah. That's a great movie.
Yeah, I love that movie. Noah Baumbach has made some really great stuff.
And I think that there's something sort of seminal about that movie because I think there's a lot of autobiographical realization in it.
Yeah.
And it feels small. And I'm... You know, I have nothing against Jesse Eisenberg, but it's not a flavor I like. You know, it's like, would you rather have chocolate cookie, you know, chocolate chip cookie dough, or would you rather have Neapolitan? I'm kind of like, I'll take the cookie dough. Like,
he's great in that movie, though.
He's amazing in that movie. Yeah. And that's the one redeeming film for Jesse Eisenberg, you know, and then you say, oh, he was Lex Luthor, the Superman thing. I'm like, yeah, but he was great in The Squid and the Whale. He's great in The Squid and the Whale.
It's good in The Social Network too.
But yeah, he's good in He sort of gets
he's
that.
He's good
too.
At those kind of smarmy characters.
He's
you know?
Good at what he is. He's good at what he is. But and I don't mean this as an aspersion because I don't think Tom Cruise could have played Bella. But he would never be able to do something like this. I just can't imagine.
That's the thing. I mean, there are lots of great.
And to be fair, I wouldn't have said Emma Stone would go these places. Like,
no,
I no. will. Like, if I ever meet her, I will shake her hand and I will say, you know, this sounds melodramatic, but I think that Poor Things changed my life. Like, as a filmmaker myself, it opened my eyes. I'm like, oh, film can be that too.
How tough is that from an acting standpoint to just completely, you know, because I imagine there has to be a. You know, when you're acting like a baby, there has to be, and I'm sure, you know, a really great actor can turn that off or whatever and completely tap into their imagination. But there has to be I would think for a lot of actors, there would have to be like, am I going to look stupid? Am I going to seem ridiculous in this?
You know, I don't
think. Are people going to laugh at me in a like not laugh at me and not laugh with me.
Yeah.
You know? So I wonder how many, and there's, I'm not disparaging anybody because there's lots of great actresses out there, but you're like, okay, how many actresses could have played this role?
Done
it the way she
did. I think at the level these folks.
Because there's a real fine line there between, you know, Oscar nomination and Razzie Award for this, you know?
I think you have to trust your director. You can't control the cut in a film, right? You can only control the performance you do in front of the camera, and then they've got everything you do in front of the camera. I don't think that actors working at that level. I'll come back to Tom Cruise for a second because I love Tom Cruise, and I think Tom Cruise is a terrific movie star. And I love Tom Cruise movies, and I will buy a ticket just because it's, you know, I watched the latest Mission Impossible, and I thought it was greatly entertaining. I think he delivers. I think he's a hardworking guy. I think he's super committed. I don't think he has an enormous range, right? Tom Cruise is not Daniel Day-Lewis.
No.
And so how many people could play this? I don't know. You know, I actually think that the baby stuff, we did stuff like that in film school. I think if you have a safe environment and you do the work on your own ahead of time, regression stuff and baby stuff and going back to the toddler thing, if it's well written in the script and you've got a director who's going to be a little patient with you while you're shooting it, right? You're not trying to rush to make a day, is less challenging than some of the sort of adolescent stuff and some of the sort of. Like, she was willing to lose herself in it. She was willing to let go of Emma Stone and just go and find Bella in there somewhere. And I think that actors like Daniel Day-Lewis and Meryl Streep do that routinely. And I actually think it's harder to be like a Meryl Streep who can play anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, she could be... Right. Tom Cruise is often named Jack and he plays some sort of version of Tom Cruise. And it's enormously entertaining and believable, right? And engaging. And that's hard enough. But a kind of an I don't know how to label it, but a kind of a craft actor who's sort of almost one of their missions is I want to find a completely new character and I want to abandon the assumptions that I as a person make in the world. Little things like the way I pick up a cup of coffee or the way I, you know, linger at the window smoking a cigarette, watching this, you know, my character wouldn't necessarily do it that way. So I'm going to find the way that my character would do it. That's an enormous amount of homework. And I really see the hallmarks of that in this performance with Emma Stone. I think watching this movie, there are a ton of actors in Hollywood that would like, I would murder for an opportunity for a role like that. Because it just showcases, you know, we see it in singers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of popular singers and there's a lot of popular songwriters. I remember watching Ariana Grande on Saturday Night Live do impressions of all these other divas.
And she's amazing.
She's like a mockingbird. I mean, she could literally make her voice do anything. And she's this little, she's maybe 100 pounds soaking wet, right? Mm-hmm. But she's got this voice that can be anything. And you think, that's just a gift of God. Mm-hmm. Like, that's incredible. That's incredible that they can do that. So I don't know how many actors could play that role. But I think a lot of A-list people could do a pretty good job at it. And I think there's just something extra remarkable about this because part of it was I didn't expect Emma Stone to vanish. There's just such a Franklin. And like, if you said, okay, we're going to shoot a shot of you, Chris, and this is you discovering masturbation, I don't think I could be that frank about it. I think I'd be in my head. I think I'd...
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult for me to get past all that shit. And she got so past it that it doesn't feel salacious.
No.
It does not feel pornographic. There's a kind of a beautiful wonder to it. And I feel gross even saying those words out loud. But watch the movie and you'll see.
I know what you mean, yeah.
You'll see what I'm talking about. It just is like, this is human. It's so good.
Seeing this in the theater, we were probably the youngest. I'd say we were the youngest people in the. I mean, there were maybe a couple other people that were maybe. There might have been a couple other people younger, maybe like in their 30s or 40s. There were a lot of older people, I'd say like 60s and 70s there. And nobody walked out or anything. You know, everybody was, you know, I think it was a thing where people. This is probably not the kind of movie that you just stumble into, you know. But I wanted to say something, this is a little bit off subject, but what you brought up about Tom Cruise, I don't know if you saw just in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it was really interesting. Some articles came out saying that he, I don't know if he started a new like branch of his production company. I may be wrong about that, but basically he has contacted some of the, I think he got in contact with like, Paul Thomas Anderson and, you know, some of these other directors that he wants to, you know, I think it's probably he's thinking, okay, I'm in my 50s now. I've got however many more years 60s. Left or whatever.
He's got to be older than this.
I think he's maybe like late 50s. I don't know if he's quite 60 yet, but around there. But he, you know, he's done, and I'm totally with you that, you know, Tom Cruise doesn't have a ton of range, but he's had 15 years or so where it just seems like he does nothing but Mission Impossible movies. And like you said, you know, they've done tremendously well, but you know, he did Magnolia and he did Vanilla Sky, you know, and he's been in some films where it's like, oh, he's not just a movie star. He's really an actor. So and they said he very much, there were no quotes from him or anything, but basically it was like, he wants to do some more, of the, you know, kind of stretch himself. And I think maybe, I'm pretty sure Paul Thomas Anderson was one that they mentioned, maybe like the Safdie brothers who did Uncut Gems, you know, cause you've got, Adam Sandler who, you know, I don't think anybody really thinks Adam Sandler's a great actor, but worked with Paul Thomas Anderson, worked with the Safdie brothers. You know, he's not bad.
Funny, but he does dramatic. I thought, oh man, what was that one? The first dramatic one he did that
was that Punch Drunk Love?
Punch Drunk Love. I have nothing negative. Again, and I'm not casting aspersions. Not everybody can do everything. Like, I certainly can't get up and sing an opera, right? And not every opera singer can sing. I don't know. This metaphor doesn't go anywhere, but you get it. It's like we all have different gifts, and not everybody is Meryl Streep either, right? Not everybody can do that.
I certainly have slammed a lot. You know, I don't dislike Adam Sandler himself, but I dislike a lot of his movies. But he has managed to, because his movies make money, and you can't really, like, if we could get somebody to give us $100 million, it wouldn't even have to be $100 million, it would be $1 million or $10 million, to just continually make movies with our friends, even if they're terrible, but they continue, that would be pretty amazing, you know?
That would be amazing. You sent me a link that really resonated with me that I think we've talked about before. It's like, you know, instead of making a $500 million movie.
That was a guy at the Oscars that won for, I think it was American Fiction.
Why don't you make, you know, 50, $10 million movies?
And we've talked about that where even if.
Or $105 million movies. Yeah.
And Disney could still take $200 million and make a Marvel movie and take another $200 million and make 10, $20 million movies. You know, there's nothing keeping them from doing that.
I think it's the way that the money is spent. And I think that a filmmaker like this that has the ability to, you know, and Christopher Nolan is another terrific filmmaker. The fact that we recognize them from blockbusters. We reviewed Enemy on here, which was an early Denis Villeneuve movie, and it's got, help me out, what's his name? Roadhouse.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal in it, but I mean, but
speaking
it's,
of, I watched like 45 minutes of Roadhouse already.
Did you? I mean, it's got Jake Gyllenhaal in it, but it's a pretty small feeling movie. It's really, you know, living rooms and kitchens and. It's not, certainly not Dune. I think that being able to be a filmmaker that can make a compelling movie and at any scale that can make those big blockbuster movies, but also tell a story. This is so cliche, but the idea of storytelling, focusing on, like, do we care about the characters? Is what happens between the characters engaging to us, right? If it's not those things, I don't care how spectacular it is, it's not going to have sustained interest. But if it does those things, then yeah, there could be spaceships and you can do world building and again, blah, 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 right? I read another article about Blade Runner 2049, which is a favorite of mine, and it's a very big movie. But I think it's hugely successful at some of those things about us coming to care about a character and follow that character's arc in the midst of doing this incredible world building, on top of which it's not just world building, it's building on top of an already built world from a different, you know, I mean, it's just so many layers of crazy. But at the core of it, you care about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in some ways, there's just, you know, studios want to put their money on people who have proven they can make a successful movie because making a movie is so hard. But I do think that you could carve a little of that off and you could kind of create part of the machine that fosters that. Right now, it feels like you're on your own. Hey, if you want to be a filmmaker, stuff is cheap. Go out and make films. Prove yourself, go to the festival circuit. If you make something great, people will notice.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then we could talk. And I almost feel like you could carve a little of that off into sort of in the farm league, you know, and figure out ways to foster that and seed that a little bit.
And while we were talking here, I looked up the budget because I didn't know what it was. $35 million was the budget for this.
For this?
For this, $35 million.
Now I'm just angry. That's not fair.
Yeah, and the thing
that's
is,
so
you
crazy.
You think, and not that there, you know, there are people want to talk about the death of movies or whatever. And even, well, you know, I've talked about so many movies being bland and studio, you know, just made by committee and all that. But we still get lots and lots of really great movies. But imagine 10 movies like this a year. That's $350 million, you know.
I'd be happy as a clam.
Yeah, I mean, if you got to see 10 movies each year that you enjoyed as much as this film, you know, it. But yeah, so 335. I don't know what it It grossed 112 worldwide. So, you know, that's a good, Searchlight Pictures is who released it.
So far, I mean, it just came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. It is. You know what's fascinating is it's so out of the box. Like, it's so weird, a movie. And, you know, The Lighthouse is a movie that we've watched that we both really like. And I love that that's weird. And that's Willem Dafoe also.
That's Robert Eggers. Yeah.
Strong art house feel to that.
And he has not, that director has Nosferatu coming out Christmas Day.
With Willem
Dafoe is in it. He's not Nosferatu.
No, it's Anya Taylor-Joy, isn't it?
Nosferatu is Bill Skarsgård for It. He's Nosferatu.
There was some talk or some article I read where they were talking about Anya Taylor-Joy playing those crazy eyes and
the bride, because it's one of these things where we have, you know, it's like, for whatever reason, there are all these Frankenstein movies being made right now, which is, I'm fine with. I mean, but so.
I think it's AI. I think that's the resonance for me, is the rise of AI and the fear of like this thing.
Yeah, that's a good.
Not being what we designed it to be, or not what we want it to be, or not doing what we tell it to do.
I never thought of that.
And playing God, that's great, right? Like, oh, we're going to build a machine that's smarter and stronger than us. Like, why did you do that? Well, just to see if we could, you know, I mean, I couldn't help myself. I, you know, and you're but, like, yep, that checks out.
But Nosferatu comes out Christmas Day. That's Robert Eggers. And then there is I believe it's Bride of Frankenstein, directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal. And Christian Bale is the monster.
Is the Bride of Frankenstein.
Is the Bride of Frankenstein, yeah. No, Christian Bale is the monster, and I believe maybe Anya Taylor-Joy is the bride.
And he's gained 800 pounds to play the...
He gained 800 pounds. He had real steel bolts...
screwed into his spine. Into him, yeah.
Screwed into his neck. But yeah, so I don't know. Is there anything else about...
No, we're over time. I mean, I really, I feel like I could pour another beer and we could just, I love, you know, we don't love every movie we do. We don't always do great movies, but I love when we get one that I could just rave about. And I know we haven't been super academic about it, but folks, if you've stuck with us, this is really a work of art, and it really is surprising and unsettling. You know, you asked if Rachel would like it. I think she would appreciate the art. I think that as a film goer, she kind of likes what she likes. And part of it to me is peeling back the layers and trying to see the machinery and how the sausage is made as a filmmaker. And she doesn't really approach movies in that way. So I'm not sure she'd like it. I'm not sure she'd like some of the violence and some of the viscera of it.
It's not a movie that I would recommend to everybody, but it... For non-Philistines, people who like interesting films.
I don't think my parents were Philistines, but I don't think my parents would have liked it.
Exactly. I'm just kidding. Yeah, my parents, if they saw this, would think it was the. It's like, I think maybe I've told you this story.
That was weird.
I think I've told you this story. So this would have been before I was born, because I think it came out in 1970 or 71. But my parents I don't think they were married yet. I think it was a date. Went to see A Clockwork Orange. Do you remember Gene Shalit, who used to be the film critic guy that was on because he went on and on about how great a movie it was. And, you know, back then there probably wasn't a way for them to like watch the trailer or anything, you know, not like you could go online and research it or whatever. And they went and like, they still talk about that as being like one of the worst movies that they've ever seen.
Oh my God. You know? But it's a great film, but it is a hard movie watching experience. I mean, it is. That traumatized me. I remember that watching that as a kid.
Have you seen it as an adult?
It's been a long time. Do you want to do that one?
Yeah, we should do that sometime. I don't think we've done any Kubrick, have we?
That coldness. Did we do 2001? I think we did 2001. Did we?
No, we haven't done 2001.
Are you sure?
I think so, yeah.
I just watched that, and that is long.
It is.
like a movie of its era. Like, there's some sequences I'm like, I get it. What happens next?
You know, one that I have also wanted to, that would be fun to do sometime, that I've wanted, because I literally have, I saw it in the movie theater. Another one talking about seeing with parents. I saw it with my brother-in-law, my sister and my brother-in-law, and his parents went. And that was a little embarrassing, was Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh yeah.
I haven't seen that since saw it in the theater. So that's one I've wanted to rewatch.
That might be interesting to rewatch.
Cause you know, it's viewed as lesser Kubrick, but I bet it probably hits differently 20 years later, you know. But I don't know. But yeah, so as far as Poor Things, for those who would be into this kind of movie, I think this movie is kind of a masterpiece.
I think it is the definition of a masterpiece, which is not to say that it's for everyone.
No.
But I think, you know, making a movie is so hard. Making a conventional movie is so hard. And this is such an utterly unconventional movie. Everybody's leaving it on the table. Like, everybody is coming in and pushing their boundaries. And, you know, I can pick. There's one little thing. Willem Dafoe has a sort of an Irish accent that sort of comes and goes.
Yeah.
That I noted. I'm not going to say it irritated me, but I was started to listen for it. I'm like, oh, he's doing it again. So that took me out of the movie slightly, because it feels like they started shooting some scenes where he did it. And maybe the director was like, I think you could just talk the way that you talk. We don't need to do, you know, which I think happens on productions from time to time, you know.
And, you know, with a movie like this, it's kind of like, I think about this, like with, like I can draw a little and I can paint a little, and I'll see some artwork that people make and I think, I can do that. And then you see somebody who's a really great artist and you're like, I don't know. I would never, you know, I could practice my entire life.
Yeah.
And I would never be able to do that.
Yeah.
And this happened a lot in the 90s. I think you watch, and not to pick on this guy, but you know, you watch Clerks and you think, I could make a movie, you know, and I mean, you've made movies before.
Yeah.
And then you watch something like this and you're like, oh, I watched there's a YouTube video that I'll have to send you that I watched last night it was a link on Twitter. And it's just this guy that does these film essays, and he has this whole thing about blocking a scene, and he shows these, I'll send it to you, because really, this is going to sound boring, but it's really interesting. And he has an Akira Kurosawa movie, and he's just talking about how he's like, here everything is framed in a triangle, and then he's like, and then over here everything is framed in a square, and I'm sitting there thinking, I've watched movies my entire life and I just had my mind blown, because it's like, oh, I never would have even known to look for that.
It's like,
right?
You get a glimpse of the Matrix and you're like, oh yeah. Snap. Yeah.
And you're like, Kurosawa, oh, this is
I started watching Throne of Blood again recently. It's really interesting. It's on Max.
Yeah. But you see and of course this happened with, obviously this happens with Kurosawa, but you watch a movie like this and you're like, oh, they'll be studying this in film classes, you know?
Yeah, I would hope so.
So it's like on a different level, you know?
And, I do make movies and I do enjoy making movies, but there's no part of me that's like, oh, I can make that one day. But, you know, that is so outside of my league. But it is really exciting to see something you've never seen before, because you go, oh, that's possible too. Like, you're like, look at that. And it is an inspiration. It's an artistic inspiration. You go, wow.
And I kind of, you know, this is going to make me, this is going to be another one I always talk about, you know, sound like get off my lawn, but it used to make me mad when I was a kid, because I would watch watch Siskel and Ebert, and there would be all these movies that I liked that they would just tear apart, and I'd just be like, they don't like movies that are fun, you know,
good movies, and they just like nerd movies.
They just like, yeah. And then, you know, they want to see a movie where it's just people sitting in a coffee shop talking or whatever. And then you get to our age and we've seen thousands of movies at this time throughout your life,
right?
And you think, oh, imagine if you were a movie critic, a real movie critic, you know, not like what we're doing, and you had to watch every movie that comes out.
I know.
And how oh, I've, you know, oh God, I'm watching, you know, Fast and the Furious 47 or whatever. Right. Another one, you know what I mean?
Right.
And especially now when there's so much, you know, there's so, so much less variety. So you know, again, not to sound snobby or anything, because I like a lot of dumb movies still, but something like this comes along and you're just like, oh, I've never seen it.
And we were kids before. And they were adults, you know?
Right. Sure.
Anyway, we should wrap it up. Chris and Chris Talk Movies at gmail.com is our handle. Thank you so much for listening. Like and subscribe, blah, blah, blah. Thank you so much. We have gotten some terrific comments back. We got some great listener comics back from Godzilla plus one and or minus one. Godzilla, you sent me the meme.
You did the mic joke.
Yeah. It's really funny. And it's just Miller's really crossing. Gratifying to hear that, yeah. You know, you guys hear a question we raise and you lend us your thoughts on it, or that's makes all of this worth. We're not making any money doing this or anything. It's just fun, but it's fun to think that people are actually listening and having thoughts about it and bothering to let us know what they are. So please keep doing that. And I love it.
For sure.
And I don't know what we'll do next time, but we'll figure it out and we'll let you know when we do it.
When it's out, you will see it.
And yeah.
Or listen to it.
Yeah. Do you have anything final you want to?
No, just especially if you have Hulu, it's just this movie's right there for you to watch.
Just check it out. It's crazy.
If it's playing, but if you are somewhere where this is still playing, I don't know if it's in theaters anymore, or maybe since she got, since she won Best Actress, maybe it's slipped back into
the
theaters.
It's a big screen movie for sure. I mean, it's good on your home screen too, but man, it's so visually gorgeous. Just
and something. I'll tell you this real quick. I don't know if there's a Regal theater around here, around you anywhere, but Regal is going, it's like next week, I think. I'll have to check and see what the date is. They're going to be playing Chinatown for just for just one night, which I think I'm going to go and see.
Yeah, great.
Because I've seen it, you know, once maybe a long, long time ago.
It's Chinatown. So,
yeah. Yeah.
All right.
All righty.
Then I guess Chris and I will talk to you all next week.